Welcome, and thanks for listening to the Voices of SUD, Let's Grow Together, a pilot podcast brought to you by Southeast Addiction Technology Transfer Center Network, better known as SATTC, where we discuss topics on substance use resources and research, challenges in the addiction workforce, workforce development for young professionals, the millennial, services and support for minority women, treatment and recovery for vulnerable populations such as the homeless, migrant, and incarcerated, faith community strategies, and the evolution of SUDs. Welcome and stay tuned.
Hello, listeners. Thanks for tuning in again. I wanted to introduce our speaker for this episode, episode 3, Sharon Heseltine, before we jump right into that conversation. So Sharon is the president and CEO of Intentional Beginnings Consulting and Training of Louisville, Kentucky, a small nonprofit with the mission of strengthening organizations and individuals serving those who experience substance use disorders, adverse childhood experiences, and trauma. Sharon received her Bachelor's of Science in Social Work from Southern Illinois University in 1981, and then went on in 2011 to complete a postgraduate certificate in infant and early childhood mental health from the University of Minnesota. For over 30 years, Sharon has worked in public health and specialized in early childhood development, women's health, and addiction. Her career has ranged from providing direct service to women through managing two sober living residencies to designing and facilitating statewide and local collaborative initiatives that call on her skills in public policy, strategic planning, cross-sector collaboration, program assessment, and marketing. She's a national trainer for the Technology Transfer Specialist for Opioid Response Network and a facilitator for multiple organizations, including the Heseltine Beatty Ford Foundation, the Addiction Technology Transfer Center, where SATTC is housed, and as well as what I said before, Opioid Response Network. In 2018, Sharon took the lead in developing the SUD-specific training for peer support specialists and supervisors for the Commonwealth of Kentucky. So you all are in for a treat. She has special passion for this area, and I can't wait to get into the conversation. So stay tuned. Thanks. Hey guys, thank you so much for tuning in again as that great introduction to our speaker for today, Sharon Heseltine. I appreciate her coming on today. She does work with me with the Opioid Response Network, so it's important to have some of our own on as well. We love external guests, but we even love even more to have one of our own guests from our sister grant, Opioid Response Network. So thank you so much, Ms. Sharon, for being with us today.
Thanks, Celine. I am really thrilled to be able to be here today and to get the opportunity to talk about one of my favorite topics in the whole world.
Yes, one of my favorite too. You can't see the bottom of my computer, but it actually has a uterus and fallopian tubes and ovaries, like a little sticker I got from a medical student studying one day. So I'm super, super ecstatic. Even in grad school myself, I studied women's reproductive and maternal, child health. You know, that was all my thing, especially when it comes to reproductive justice. So I'm excited. So, I mean, just starting off, because we have one vested interest and goal of ours is to introduce new pathways into substance use behavioral health field. Just tell us what your background in maternal health is, and just kind of what, where you fit into the scheme of things. I know this is an expertise for you. So just wanted to share that a little bit just so we can give, we always call them pre-service professionals, just so they can hear the different pathways. Not everybody has to prescribe medications for SUDs, or not everybody has to be a mental health counselor, or, there's a lot of different things out here to do. So we always like to share that with our young professionals, especially our younger listeners.
Well, thanks, Celine. I think, for me, it's been a combination of things, right? Part of it is just time, right? Time in the field. But when you're a young professional, time seems like it moves too fast, or you just don't want to wait that long. my background educationally is social work, but I've always worked in public health.
Yeah, me too.
I went to a year of nursing school, and I don't think that that's like on my resume or anyway. I thought I wanted to be a nurse for a while, and then after a year, I was like, I might accidentally kill somebody. And so I went and worked in public health with what was a brand new program in the state of Illinois at the time called Parents Too Soon. No judgment there. This is like in the 80s.
Okay.
And it was a home visitor with pregnant and parenting adolescents, and ended up being the program director for those programs, and really worked for that same health department in southernmost Illinois for a total of 19 years. So over 19 years, right? Grants come, grants go, opportunities come and go. And over that period of time, home visiting and maternal and child health home visiting was really our constant. Now, on top of that, I was also outside of my work life really cultivating a pretty serious substance use disorder myself. Mm-hmm. I'm never going to find a good explanation for how I managed to do pretty, really very well professionally in the midst of all of that. Mm-hmm. But I did for a lot of years. And that led me to seeking treatment and getting well. I've been in long-term recovery for the last 16 years now at this point. Eventually, I landed working in state public health. But again, maternal and child health, home visiting, that has really been the area that I focused on the most. Mm-hmm. I had this opportunity, though, in Minnesota to do a 2-year postgraduate certificate program in infant and early childhood mental health. And for me, that was...
Yeah.
That's an unusual combination. That so, right, is. I've got this combination of public health, maternal and child health, infant mental health, which is really all about parent-child relationships and supporting healthy social and emotional development of our next generation, and then kind of how the two generations are really very much intertwined.
Yeah.
Great fit for home visiting. And then we add in there, I think, the very personal story of knowing what it's like to be a parent in active addiction and have your parenting so far removed from how you wanted to be as a parent, and the guilt and the shame and all the things that go along with that, to being a parent in recovery and really
whole
being
nother
able
beast.
To,
huh? I said a whole nother beast.
Right. It's a whole nother thing. I mean, in recovery, I'm a parent beyond what I had imagined myself to ever be. Mm-hmm. And my real passion is being able to be involved in and support and make a difference in a way where the end result is fewer people have to experience what I experienced, which is this looking back on long periods of time and the guilt that goes with it. I love for other parents to have the opportunity to be the parents that they've always dreamed that they wanted to be from the very beginning. And I use that language very purposefully, right? The parent that you want to be. Mm-hmm. I stay away from language like good parent and bad parent and all those kind of judgments, because it's really how we want to be as parents. I absolutely believe everybody really strives to be their best.
That's important. I like that. That kind of, you know, ties into a lot of the stigmatizing language and the language that we use when it comes to persons with SUDs in general, not even just, you know, parenting it as a mother or any of that. But I appreciate, you know, those words as well. I don't even think some people even think of stuff like that, you know, because immediately when someone is pregnant and or parenting and, you know, experiencing an SUD, it's like, oh, a bad parent. That just automatically equals bad parent a lot of times. So I appreciate that. Well, some of us may know and some don't. Women of color in particular, but women in general, have a greater risk for, you know, different issues compared to just when they're not pregnant, and very complicated by SUDs and substance use disorders and other behavioral health conditions. So marrying the two together creates barriers. It creates just a lot of different... just this bubble of, I say, a consortium or collaboration of just all different types of disparities and disproportionately, you know, stigmatized when it comes to SUDs. I think there's an overall stigmatization of persons with SUDs, but then when you're pregnant with SUDs, I think it's a whole nother, you know, gamut of, you know, problems. So I wanted to talk on that a little bit about just the differences you see in women that are either pregnant or parenting while going through substance use disorder treatment, and just how it really differs. It's really its own unique approach to care for those specific group of women.
It really is. I think, this conversation, we'd miss the boat if we didn't talk at all about stigma, as as you brought up, right? Because there's a lot of stigma around individuals with a substance use disorder in general. And I think that really the most stigmatized group that we see are pregnant women and parenting women when there is a substance use disorder present. I think it goes back to this underlying belief somehow that there's a choice involved, right?
Yeah.
And we know that, and I do a ton of training in the work that I do both for ORN and outside of the Opioid Response Network for my business, Intentional Beginnings, that we have this idea that a choice is involved. And I always will talk about when the brain becomes an addicted brain. Mm-hmm. Right. When the brain crosses over kind of that invisible line and undergoes the brain changes that are inherent to the disease of addiction, to substance use disorder, mm-hmm. that's the point that the power of choice is gone.
Right.
And we all start with a choice.
Right.
But at some point in time, that choice is removed. And I think when you put that together with someone who's pregnant, it's really hard for folks to wrap their head around the idea that there's not choice involved. I think as a person who's experienced this myself, sometimes, especially in relationship to myself, I will fall back into how could I have done that? How right. could I have been like that? Mm-hmm. My daughter, Leah, deserved so much more, right? Mm-hmm. She deserved a parent who was really present for her all throughout those years in my own active addiction. Mm-hmm. And I will say those things to myself, even though I know full well. At that point, I had no choice. Mm-hmm. So that the stigma is pervasive and the self-stigma is pervasive. Earlier this week, we had the opportunity to pilot a 2-day training designed for peer support specialists okay. who work with pregnant and parenting families. And on day 2, we had this really rich conversation as we opened the day where a lot of the peers talked about the guilt that they still carry. And I think we come to the conclusion as a group that the guilt doesn't ever fully go away. Mm-hmm. And that all goes back to this underlying feeling that there should be choice. And that whole piece around choice is really a driver of stigma with this population.
So what are... when it comes to stigma, what are some things that you have seen? You clearly just zeroed all of my little experience in with your 19 years. You have definitely have a wide array more than me, but I know
I'm
I've
just
seen
older, that's all.
I know you've seen more, but I know I've seen certain things as well. When it comes to stigma, what are some things that you've seen in just like actively in those public health settings where a pregnant mother is seeking care or either right there right after birth of the child? What do those situations look like? Because some people actually might not know, like, what actually happens when either a child is born, addicted to a certain substance, or what if the child isn't addicted? I know a lot of times women are kind of reluctant to share their substance use if they're, going to be compromised by the child being taken away. Or how does that look right there? Like, do they start receiving substance use treatment during pregnancy or right after? Like, how does that situation right there look, right before they give birth and kind of right after?
Well, one of the things we want to talk about first
okay.
is that babies can't be born addicted.
Okay.
And so we're really careful about... and we use that term a lot, and I think
I use what I've heard. They have NAS,
right? Well, they may have neonatal opioid withdrawal syndrome. We hear it referred to as neonatal abstinence syndrome mm-hmm. a lot, but we always want to think about. We had a great discussion about this exact thing in training earlier this week. Is that And we hear that term a lot, right? Addicted babies. But we want to think about that. Addiction is a disease of the brain, and there's certain specific structural or neurobiological changes that occur in the brain when addiction is present. When a baby is born,
they don't even have that.
Newborn baby,
yeah,
right? Newborn baby, and their brain development, they have lots and lots of brain cells, but there's not connectivity between them,
right?
So it's not even possible,
okay,
for babies, right? A baby to have the disease of addiction, they can be born physically dependent, and okay, particularly with opiates, right? And about 50% of babies where there's been opiate, not just exposure, but whether mom's been on medication or whether she's been using street drugs during her pregnancy, about 50% of babies will experience neonatal opioid withdrawal syndrome, which is a withdrawal syndrome in a newborn baby. We can, you know, we can talk about that separately, but they don't have the disease of addiction. You know, one of the hallmarks of addiction is compulsive drug-seeking behavior. So that's one of the things I always say is I've yet to see a newborn who's capable of compulsive drug-seeking.
Exactly.
You know, I think to the group the earlier in the week, I joked around and I said, yeah, you know, they're not out there writing bad checks to get money to go buy drugs.
Right.
So it's always really important. And I see that language a lot. And I see that language in the media.
Right. And I think that's probably where I've gotten it from, or friends of mine that, you know, they were, you know, children who, you know, were born right when their mother was, you know, going through the, you know, the process of, you know, trying to, you know, not, you know, have a SUD or, you know, whatever the case is. I've heard it from actual children who've grown up to be adults now. They use, like, I was a baby addicted. I was a crack baby, or I was addicted to when I was born. Like, I've heard, you know, so maybe, you know, and that's my ignorance of just listening to the media or persons with those lived experiences being, you know, having that language too.
I said earlier this week, it's for all of us, right? When we know better, we do things differently. So mm-hmm. I think it's just important that we're clear about that, because that helps every listener change their language.
It changed mine immediately, because it makes total sense from a biological and physiological point of view. I've got that down, like bio pre-med, studying for MCAT for medical school. I have that down. That makes total sense now. But, you know, of course, the media and all these other outside influences, you know, we just say, you know, what we're hearing. So I have it clear in my head now.
I'm actually glad they used the term, because it gave us an opportunity to talk about it. And yes, I don't know if it would have come up otherwise. So I think that is really helpful. But stigma, right? How does it look? And I'll just give some examples of things of how that looks, right? It looks like women who have had substance use disorder, or maybe they test positive, or baby's meconium tests positive for substances, not being allowed to be with their baby, in the hospital.
Big problem.
Babies with neonatal opioid withdrawal syndrome who are severe enough where they have to go into a neonatal intensive care unit, mothers not being with them, or mothers being treated like they don't love their babies, not receiving the same support and the same coaching and the same engagement in their baby's care. And it's really stigmatizing to the mother. It's also medically not the best for the baby. We know that babies who have neonatal opioid withdrawal syndrome actually do better when their mothers are involved in their care. It also looks like, and I want to talk specifically to women who are undergoing treatment for an opioid use disorder and on our medication to treat that opioid use disorder, they also are treated in the same kind of stigmatizing way at the time of delivery. So even though they're in treatment and even though they're going on medication, I mean, I have stories from where I live of women who have had, and this happens all over the country, it's not unique to where I live, women who've had their babies removed right out of the hospital, who the baby's meconium doesn't test positive for anything other than buprenorphine.
And what is meconium, just for listeners' sake?
Oh, thank you. Meconium, right, is the first bowel movement that a baby has after they've been born. And so when they test that meconium, it's going to show substances that have been used over a period of time. Whereas if they test the mom's urine at the time of delivery, depending on the substance, what's going to show up, you know, maybe something that was used in the last, you know, 48 to 72 hours.
Okay.
Except for marijuana, which is going to kind of stay in your urine.
So it's a longer historical trace of usage of things, different things.
Right. You know, and we've seen those situations. I've seen mothers who are in residential treatment, and active and engaged in voluntary residential treatment programs who have had their babies removed and put into foster care.
I've heard that. Yeah, I've heard that.
It happens all over this country. And, and when you're in a residential treatment with 24/7 staff, like, your baby's not at imminent risk of harm.
Right.
We shouldn't be putting babies into foster care situations. You know, the disruption in relationships for babies under the age of one particularly is really devastating for their long-term development and their sense of security, which is a whole other kind of subject, right? So we, I mean, but we see things like that happening, right, all the time, all over this country. And they're just, you know, they're examples of stigma. Where I've worked in home visiting programs, you know, I've heard folks who work in that field say, and I will quote, "You would think she loved her children enough to quit having all that fun partying all the time." But we know from the disease of addiction, at the point in time the brain becomes an addicted brain, it's not fun anymore. It's not a party. It's not about, woohoo, this is great. It's about a level of compulsivity that is a disease. And I think it's always interesting that, you know, if we have women who have gestational diabetes, who don't manage their diet in a way that's recommended, their babies can have some pretty difficult challenges when they're born.
Yep.
And nobody says this about them.
Right, right. Exactly. I think I love when we always compare, especially in the field ourselves, we compare like a regular chronic disease, and then that, you know, everybody's like, okay, you have diabetes, let's treat you, let's help you, and then to what we do with people with substance use disorders. I love that comparison because it gets people to really understand that addiction is a disease and it should be treated in the same manner as any other acute chronic, you know, kind of, you know, disease. So I love that. You said you wanted to talk about initiating pharmacotherapy for opioid use disorder when it comes to mothers. We can switch gears to that. I like our listeners to stay short on time. So what, a pregnant woman with an opioid use disorder requests treatment. How does that look? I know there's a lot of different controversial, you know, things about that.
Yeah, it's interesting, right? So treatment for opioid use disorder, I guess, right, the controversy is medication. And we think it's controversial.
Right.
Should people be able to have a medication to treat an opioid use disorder? Well, here's what, you know, we know. Interestingly, the only place that's controversial for pregnant women is just people with opinions, because in the medical field.
Amen.
There is no controversy.
There's no risk of increased birth defects or anything with pharmacotherapy for OUDs for a woman.
Not that we have seen, nor is there any research at this point in time that demonstrates long-term developmental problems for children. And I think that's really...
Yep.
Right? So we got to look at this in the big picture. First of all, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, as well as the American Society of Addiction Medicine, are absolutely clear in their recommendations that medication is the appropriate treatment for pregnant women with an opioid use disorder. The risk is the risk to the baby, about a 50% risk of developing neonatal opioid withdrawal syndrome, which we know how to treat. It is time limited. We know how to treat it. We know how to treat it really well. Unfortunately, we've had a lot of practice with the opioid epidemic at treating neonatal opioid withdrawal syndrome in our NICUs, but it is a time-limited issue. So let's back up to what leads to the healthiest pregnancy outcome for anybody, right? Adequate and regular prenatal care.
Yep.
Right? Good nutrition. Both stress,
yes,
right, moderate amount of exercise, right, all those kinds of things. Well, I don't know anybody in active addiction who's doing that.
Oh, right, good point.
I mean, that's just not congruent with active addiction.
What that shows up as.
Mm-hmm. Right? Then the other side of it with active addiction for opiates and folks being IV drug users is continued IV drug use increases your risk of HIV, mm-hmm. of hepatitis C, of abscesses and endocarditis. Like none of that's really conducive to a healthy pregnancy outcome. I mean, our goal is for a pregnancy to go, right, 38 to 40 weeks, for the baby to weigh over 5.5 pounds, right, for everybody to be healthy. So active substance use is way less likely to lead to those kind of outcomes than treatment with medication is, right? Treatment with medication provides stability, getting engaged in treatment, comprehensive treatment that's not just about medication, but comprehensive, robust behavioral health.
Yep, intervention, yep.
All of those pieces, right? Case management, peer support, yeah, you know, all those pieces together really support women and families in a healthier birth outcome. Now, mm-hmm. the other thing we know is that medication, and for pregnant women, we're talking about buprenorphine or methadone. Those are the two recommended yep. medications. Yep. Medication for anybody with an opioid use disorder reduces their risk of overdose death by 50%. Now, I just want y'all to think about something, our listeners, because we're in the midst of COVID. Mm-hmm. Someone came out tomorrow and you opened up your Twitter feed and saw, we have got medication that will reduce your risk of getting COVID by 50%, or let's just say it reduced everybody's risk of having a severe case and dying of COVID by 50%. Like, we would be all over it.
Mm-hmm.
All over it. Right? Mm-hmm. We have medication that does that for opioid use disorder. And we got a whole lot of people with a whole lot of opinions that say, well, we just shouldn't make that available to yep. folks, that it's not real recovery, or it's a substituting one drug for another. And we want to talk about in pregnancy and creating the safest environment for an unborn baby and for a newborn baby. Well, it seems like reducing the risk that the mother would die by 50% probably makes a whole lot of sense, mm-hmm. right? Increasing the chances of a full-term pregnancy with a healthy birth weight baby, that makes a whole lot of sense as well. And, and reducing the risk of infection, very serious infection, makes sense. Oftentimes I'll say when someone with an opioid use disorder who's active gets pregnant, that's not the greatest. It's not an ideal situation.
Mm-hmm.
We can make it an ideal situation, but we can make it a much better, healthier situation for everybody involved.
Exactly. I appreciate that. SAMHSA does have a resource I think is really good. I've read it a good amount of it. It's pretty lengthy, but it has tons of different fact sheets, clinical guidance for treating pregnant and parenting women with opioid use disorders and their infants. Really, really good resource. I've saved it on my computer all the time, but it's really thorough and goes through a lot of the different steps. Really quickly, just to wrap us up, this has been a great conversation. Miss Sharon is here for a good time, not a long time. So I just wanted to get your final thoughts about what are some really those last driving points that you want to drive home to listeners when it comes to maternal health and women that are experiencing substance use disorder and how it affects their children.
So I'll tell you what, I would have been true to myself. And one of the things that I always like to convey to folks, if I didn't talk about, you know, after babies are born and when women or families are in our treatment systems with their children, I can't emphasize enough how critical it is to keep women together with their babies. We separate them so often, you know, even like in our residential programs, we provide child care for babies and we tell women, focus on your treatment, and then we'll focus on parenting. And really quickly, with the disease of addiction, this is not the language I like to use, but it's some of the easiest to understand, the reward system that drives the behaviors that help our species survive is hijacked by substances, and our reward system and our brain comes to believe that our substances are needed to survive. That same reward system drives parenting behavior. Makes sense? We need to, right, parent and nurture and protect our babies or they're not going to survive.
Mm-hmm.
So it makes sense So with that, when we separate women from their infants, we've taken away one of the greatest opportunities to reset that reward system. You know, we talk about this term called salience for the brain, salient cues, like the most important thing. Mm-hmm. And in an active addiction, the most salient cue for the reward system is the substance. In parenting, early parenting, when substances aren't involved, the most salient cue for the reward system is that baby. Mm-hmm. So we have this phenomenal opportunity when women are pregnant at the time of their addiction and in early recovery when the baby is born, to help that reward system reset to something other than the substance. And then what we turn around and we do is we separate the baby. And it's not helpful for the baby either. Babies need to be with their parents to be calm and to be regulated. Parental bonding oftentimes is a slower process with women in early recovery or in an active addiction. There's a lot of neurobiological and hormonal reasons why that's the case. But it's a slower process. And when it happens through routine caregiving of the baby. So it happens over time through routine caregiving. And for the baby, the babies need their parents to learn how to regulate their internal states, to form a sense of trust, safety, and security in the world, all of those pieces. So it makes no sense. It only makes sense for treatment providers because it's a whole lot easier to run groups and to run treatment when we're not also navigating babies. Mm-hmm. What I'll say is anybody who wants to make the switch, reach out to me. I know providers who have done it, who can help other treatment providers do the same. We have tons of training available and resources and supports that we can bring through the Opioid Response Network to help providers shift the way they serve this population. We can do better. We can just do better.
And on that note, I will wrap it up. That was perfect to end on. Thank you so much, Ms. Sharon. I love the plug for Opioid Response Network. Anytime we can plug our work, I love to plug it in. But it just proves that SATTC, coupled with ORN, we both do amazing work. I love the fact that we are a free resource to the community through federal-funded opportunities grant and programs. So thank you so much, Ms. Sharon. You've heard it from her. Tons of resources available for readily used at a fingertip from SAMHSA on just a natural search on the internet. But we can give tailored response to your needs for the community through Opioid Response Network, along with SATTC or any ATTC in the region that you coincide with. So thank you so much, Sharon. Ms. Sharon has to run, but I appreciate you all. And tune in for our next episode. This is our third episode of our new season. We're excited. We've got tons of women on our episodes so far. So I love the girl power, and we appreciate you, Ms. Sharon. Thanks for joining us, and be sure to check us out on the web at attcnetwork.org/centers/southeast-ATTC/home. We'll see you soon.